I think there still exists in our day and time a reverence for the relationship of marriage. I think most people that enter into a marital covenant do so with a desire that it lasts, that it continues for a lifetime. However, statistically, things are not that encouraging when we consider how many of those marriages do last. And I think that among a growing number of people in our society, there is simply a desire to live together outside of that covenant rather than enter into the covenant and see it be broken. And so when we begin to look statistically at what's happening in our society relative to the rate of those who are marrying, or negatively, the rate of those that are choosing to cohabit, to live together apart from the covenant of marriage, there is some cause, I think, for alarm. In doing some research for the lesson, and I'll try not to overburden you with statistics, but I did find some things that were interesting. Over one half of all first marriages contracted in our country are preceded by living together. I would not have guessed that high. I don't know what you're thinking about that would be. But one half of all of the first marriages are preceded by cohabitation. Between 1960 and 2004, cohabitation increased 1,200%. I knew that that figure was increasing. I would not have guessed that high again. Just between 1990 and 2000, the rate of cohabitation in our country increased 72% just in that one decade alone. And so what I think we begin to see in regard to the growing failure of marriage is a desire on man's part to establish his own boundaries and standards of relationship. And in doing so, what we're beginning to see by these statistics is we're beginning to see an increase of cohabitation, at least on the part of some, as a form of trial marriage. Rather than make the covenant and then see the covenant broken, perhaps it would be better if we just live together. Or, maybe with more noble purposes in mind, we live together to see if we're compatible, so that when we marry, the marriage will have a better chance at staying together. That's the sort of thought that I would like for us to examine in the lesson this morning. Would you open your Old Testaments to Genesis 1? And as we've been doing some more frequent lessons on marriage and the family in the past few weeks, I find myself at the beginning of each of these lessons turning to Genesis 1, which is what Jesus did, so I suppose we're in fairly good company there. In Matthew 19, when Jesus wanted to talk about marriage and answer a question particularly on divorce, he went back to Genesis 1, wherein we find at the outset of the creation of man, the standards and the organization, if you will, the relationship that God sets in motion, that's relative to the purpose for which He made man. Look at Genesis 1 and verse 28. After declaring His intent to make man in His own image and what all that means. Verse 28 says, "Then God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" God made man to be physically fruitful. That is, to produce other life like himself. Be fruitful and multiply, specifically fill the earth. God wanted the earth populated. And it's interesting, as we read through on into Genesis 2, how God designed for people to multiply and the earth to be filled. And in fact, in verse 28 of chapter 1, to actually subdue and have dominion over the earth. God wanted us to, if you will, take control of the world and harness the elements of the world for our good and for our benefit, to overcome certain elements of the world that were set in motion when the sin in chapter 3 occurred. What is the mechanism? What is the organization that God puts in place for man to multiply and fill the earth and be fruitful and subdue it? As we go further on, we see that He establishes marriage and the family unto the fulfillment of that created purpose. In verse 20 of chapter 2, "So Adam gave names to all the cattle, to the birds of the air, to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found a helper comparable to him. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib which the Lord God had taken from man, he made into a woman. And he brought her to the man, and Adam said, 'This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh.'" In other words, God, though He, it is affirmed in the Scriptures, establishes government. Romans 13 speaks to that more extensively. God is the one who establishes that men govern themselves in civil and in criminal matters. He did not establish government to populate the earth and to subdue it. God establishes various institutions, but the institution that He establishes, the relationship that He establishes so that men can multiply and be fruitful and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over it, that's the family. And more specifically, I want you to notice that God doesn't create a commune. That is, God does not create a large and loose association of people who are living together in a large family segment with various mothers and fathers and husbands and wives in order to fulfill this purpose that He has for mankind. God didn't create a commune. He didn't create a harem wherein one man might have a multiplicity of wives and scads of children. That's not what God created either. He didn't create, as we hear sometimes in a political realm, a village. God didn't say it takes a village to raise a child. God created one man and one woman and put them together in an exclusive relationship. A relationship that was intended to be permanent. And within the realm of that permanent committed relationship, children were to be born. And through that basic structure, the earth to be filled and subdued. Simply put, human beings function the best when they respect and they implement God's structure as the very basis of society being marriage and the family. Because this is God's plan, deviations from that plan are considered to be sinful. And so when we think about man's solution to marriages breaking up and covenants being violated, man's solution would just be to live together without that covenant. We find that the Bible very clearly calls that sin. In fact, there's a particular word for that particular action, and that's called fornication. Turn to Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4. We may call this arrangement something more harmless, like trial marriage. But God calls living together, and that would obviously include sexual fulfillment. God calls living together in a marital type arrangement without the covenant. He calls that fornication. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, we have this very clear assessment of this arrangement. Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Now let me tell you, that's not the Embry-Hills doctrine. That's not Jim Jonas's doctrine. That's not just some highly backward and restricted cultural outlook. That is from God. Marriage is honorable among all because going all the way back to the beginning, that's the arrangement of God to be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth. And it's in that arrangement, too, that we're going to find God providing what we need physically and emotionally and spiritually, what we need to thrive and be everything God wants us to be. Fornicators and adulterers God will judge, but this is not said to restrict pleasure. Within the bounds of marriage, men can fulfill themselves with the various pleasures that God places before us in a marital relationship. It's not to restrict pleasure, but to restrain evil. When we find, even with the best intentions, this arrangement, marriage and a lifelong covenant between two people, when we find this arrangement being broken, altered in some way, a substitute made for it, we begin to see sociological, cultural problems. We begin to see psychological and emotional problems. And this is simply because God made us and He knows how we're best going to function and thrive. And so when God says fornicators and adulterers that He's going to judge, He's trying to impress upon us, for one, the importance of doing what God would have us do in the marital relationship, being what God would have us to be, and warn us away from self-destructive behaviors. But let me suggest something to you at this point. I will admit that there's some element of rationale for this that might sound plausible on first glance. And that rationale would be, well, how do you know you ought to buy it without a test drive? How do I know that I should marry this person unless we try it out first? If you're going to be spending a lot of money on a car like that, you probably want some kind of assurance that it's going to be worth the money that you're putting into it. And if you translate that kind of thinking over to marriage, I think it's easy for us to think that, well, if I'm going to enter into a lifelong, permanent relationship, I'd best find out everything about that person I can, and it would just seem like a matter of wisdom to test it out first. What's wrong with that kind of thinking? On first examination, it might sound somewhat plausible and reasonable, but let's think about it just a little bit more. Number one, it treats a person as an object. If I'm considering buying an expensive car or a plasma TV or whatever it is I'm beginning to invest heavily in, I'm only considering that thing from one point of view. Is it going to make me happy? Is the picture going to be clear? Is it going to have the kind of pickup or the gas mileage or the luxurious appointments? Is it going to have everything that I want? I mean, the car is not assessing me as an owner. Is it going to drive me into the ground? Is it going to wear the rubber off my tires? What's he going to do? The car is an object. So when I figure that I want to test drive the car or maybe rent one for a while so I can see if I'm going to like it, that's a one-way street. I'm looking at that car as an object. No harm, no foul. No immorality in that. But we can't treat people that way. We begin treating people like objects. And we're beginning to build in from the very foundation in this relationship disastrous principles and things that are going to naturally undermine the relationship we're trying to explore. And so a person is not an object. Secondly, a trial marriage or cohabitation or living together to see whether it will work is missing the most fundamental element that will be present in a marriage, and that's commitment. This is where this becomes nonsensical. You can't try it out when it's missing a fundamentally important element. What you're trying out is going to be something different than what you're going to enter into, and it's not uncommon for people to live together in trial marriage for a period of years, only then to marry and divorce shortly thereafter. How does that happen? I'm going to give you some statistics on that in just a minute. How does that happen? I suggest what happens is you're living together in an artificial situation with no commitment, wherein you might be able to keep your focus outside of the relationship and on other things. But once that commitment becomes permanent, you marry, that changes the rules of the game. And so you're not really trying it out. You're trying out something else that's not marriage. You know, every great endeavor, everything that is worth doing that we might even assess as human beings, it's not even spiritual. But great endeavors and great achievements always have to overcome great obstacles. And overcoming those obstacles takes commitment. That you can't just try out a thing and see if you like it, to see if it will work, lacking the commitment that it'll take to make it work. Biblically speaking, we might think of someone like Abraham, who is told by God to take all of his possessions and all of his family and everything that he has and leave Ur, his homeland, and go out to a place that God would show him. There wasn't a practice for that. There was no trial, Lord, let me go out here 100 miles and see how this works. I mean, for Abraham to be able to commit himself to this great endeavor, there was no trial. There were going to be huge hardships and obstacles along the way. He was going to have to be committed to God first in order to obey that command, which brought great challenges. Moses was challenged to lead the Israelites out of Egyptian captivity. And there were going to be terrible hardships that he was going to have to endure. He couldn't practice that. In fact, he tried on his own account, and that was a miserable failure in killing the Egyptian. But he had to come to an understanding of God and be committed to God in order then to take on this great task of leading these obstinate and rebellious people for 40 years. Only himself to be shut out of the land of promise at the end of that. Daniel had to be committed already to God, to remain pure in Babylonian society and put God first at the risk of losing his own life. Those things, there weren't practice for them. You had to be committed in order to do them, or you'd have given up. In a more, perhaps, secular application, if you're going to make it to the top of Mount Everest, you can't just gather your equipment and go halfway up the mountain to see how you like it. You won't like it. Climbing Mount Everest isn't about liking it. It's about facing threats to your, not your health, but your life. You have to be committed to that goal before you embark on the journey. There's other preparation to be made, but it's not on Mount Everest. You can't practice on Mount Everest. You're committed, and this is why people die on the mountain. They're wholly committed to getting to the top, oftentimes pushing themselves beyond the limits that they should and losing their life. You can't practice something that takes great commitment without having the commitment. The commitment must come first, the determination to see it through and make it happen, and then you apply yourself to what takes that degree of commitment. So living together without marriage is fundamentally different than living together with a commitment. So you can't equate the two things. Let me share this ultimate point with you, and that is, it just doesn't work. I mean, if we just want to look at this pragmatically, it flat doesn't work. It may sound good to the human ear. Oh, well, you know, maybe if we try it out, then we'll find out whether it'll work. It doesn't work. Let me share with you this observation. This is from, and I would recommend that you do some research on your own, as I've done in preparation for the sermon. There's one particular very, very detailed study that's been done by the CDC. And it's lengthy and it's tedious. It's 103 pages long, but I've boiled down some of that to this particular observation. But I want you to think about what's being said here relative to trying out marriage. How are we doing up there? I think we're a little smaller today than we're supposed to be on the screen. I'll read it. The risk of divorce after living together is 40 to 85% higher than the risk of divorce after not living together. In other words, those who live together before marriage are almost twice as likely to divorce than those who did not live together. And you might, first of all, look at the statistic and go, how could it be 40 to 85%? That's rather imprecise. I think those two figures came from looking at whether the marriage remained intact after 5 years or after 10. It's why it's 40 to 85. In other words, within 10 years of marrying after cohabiting, 85% of those marriages break up. You see my point? It doesn't work. This is not counting how many people cohabit and then come to the conclusion it's not going to work, and so they go their separate ways. These are people that marry after cohabiting. The divorce rate is much greater than those that don't. So at the end of the day, this reasoning just simply doesn't hold up under study. And I'm going to tell you at least part of the reason why, I think. Let's go back to the car buying analogy. I would suggest to you that people are getting married and looking at partners about like buying a car. Because you know and I know when we buy that car, it ain't going to last 40 years. So we're looking usually at the best value at the moment, and in view of 5 or 10 years, maybe 15 of driving. But we're looking at this nice little fancy sports car, or we family people are looking at minivans, or whatever we're looking at, and we're assessing that object, that vehicle, for my immediate needs, realizing the likelihood of it breaking, wearing out, or just not being fit anymore for our family situation. If that happens, we will just get another one. And so when we look at marriage like car buying, we're going to get a series of automobiles. We're going to get a series of marriage partners. So long as we keep looking at it like buying a car or having an object in our possession. Well, how do we prepare for marriage if we don't get the chance to practice it? This is something that is of vital importance. It is a lifelong commitment. How are we going to look at entering into this relationship if there are no trial runs, as it were? We'll talk about that. Let me suggest this to you. Statistically speaking, the greatest danger to marriage is in the first 2 years of the marriage. And this comes from a lot of the detailed studies that were done in that CDC report and some others that essentially came to the same conclusion. We've tended to hear this seven-year figure, that 7 years is the crucial time of marriage, you know, and a lot of divorces happen at that seven-year mark. But let me tell you why that ends up being skewed. 7 years appears to be just the amount of time that people can stand it when a marriage isn't founded on the right things. In other words, what is coming forth from research being done is the cracks in the foundation of the marriage are there early. People may last another 5 or 6 years after they begin this marital relationship that they know is not going to work deep down inside. But it seems like 7 years is about as long as people can take it. So the 7-year mark is not really that accurate in terms of the causes of divorce. But what that statistic tells me is this: it's what I bring to the marriage from the start that is of crucial importance. You know, you can't practice being the president. And I've often wondered about these guys that step into the role of leading the nation and how complicated an undertaking that is. And they, first of all, are only guaranteed 4 years. That's 4 years to figure out what in the world you're doing. How do you envision the comprehensive nature of all the decisions that need to be made, policies that need to be set, people to be put in certain places as cabinet, and on and on and on. And then get that machinery moving and going in a certain direction and do anything in 4 years or in 8. But you know what? You don't get to practice it. You're president. When you're inaugurated, you're president. You got to perform. Well, when we get married, when we say I do, We've got to bring something to the table. Then. I'm not saying the marriage won't grow and the people in the marriage won't grow. A man who's president will grow in that office, hopefully. But my point is, you don't have time to practice it. You've got to bring something. God doesn't give us a grace period and say, well, if you divorce in the first 2 years, it doesn't count. So that puts a lot of premium on the development of our character before we ever make the commitment. It is this period of time, if you're a middle-aged teenager, 14, 15, 16, 17, you're beginning to be aware of yourself and you're beginning to be aware of self-responsibility. You're beginning to be aware that relationships are on the horizon for you. These are the times to consciously start thinking about it, but hopefully as parents we've been instilling within our children some principles and ideals from even before that time. Preparing them gradually and along until such a time they get involved with someone that is certainly heading toward a permanent relationship, they are bringing deep and godly character to the relationship to start with. This is where the thinking has to be done. This is where the preparing has to be done. This is where the personal insight has to come from. And this is where the standards of God come into play. Would you turn back to Colossians 3, where our reading was this morning. Colossians, the third chapter. And I'm speaking in this lesson from the standpoint of talking to Christians, because that's mostly who I'm talking to this morning. You may be here and not a Christian, and that's wonderful. We're glad you're here. Hopefully something will be said to interest you in these spiritual things. But primarily in speaking to those of us who are Christians, for us, what we bring to the marriage from the start to get it started on the right foundation is really our commitment to Christ. That's going to be the greatest thing you can ever do, either for your mate if you're already married or for your mate-to-be if you're not. The greatest thing you can do is commit yourself wholly and fully to Christ. That is going to establish the foundational principles that will establish the marriage on a good footing to start with and then allow for it to grow and develop on a good foundation from that time on. If then you are raised with Christ, verse 1, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above and not on things on the earth. For you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you will also appear with Him in glory. Now, you see in those four verses, the relationship with Christ, it's been established in the life of a Christian. Seeking those things that are above, not focusing on things that are merely temporal. But now look at the character issue that comes in verse 5. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth. And I want you to read these thinking of marriage. Okay? That's not specifically what he's talking about here, but the same principles apply. The character of a Christian in marriage or as an employee or an employer, a citizen of the nation, it doesn't matter. Therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication. Fornication heads the list. As a sign of a carnal man, not a spiritual man. Uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness. You think those traits, putting those elements out of marriage would help it? Purging our character of those kinds of distractions, do you think that would help a marital relationship? Sure it would. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming on the sons of disobedience. I could probably also add, without destroying the idea altogether, because of these things, marriages crumble. In which you also once walked when you lived in them, but now you must put off all these. Think of marriage. Anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another. You think this applies to marriage? Do not lie to one another, since you put off the old man with his deeds and put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge, according to the image of Him who created him. Guess where we are? We're back in Genesis 1. According to the image of Him who created him. We're created in the image of God to multiply and fill the earth, and God arranges for us to be in marriages that are a lifetime and monogamous. How do you do that? It's what character you bring to the marriage that's going to make the difference, not trying it out. If we don't have the right kind of character, trying it out is not going to help. It's an internal issue. It's who we are and who the other person is entering that marital relationship that's going to determine whether it meets God's standards of being a lifetime commitment. Now, the point I want you to see here is this. It's not until we learn to see ourselves properly and become the kind of person we should be, it's not until then that we're going to see another human being as we should. Let me just refer you back to the example of Joseph. Genesis 39:9, when Joseph is a slave in Potiphar's household, and you remember Potiphar's wife evidently is in an unfulfilled marriage, and she begins to make overtures to Joseph. Now look, this lady was a powerful woman. I don't know whether there's any attractiveness to her or not physically, but that's beside the point. This is his boss's wife, his master's wife. And she keeps making these overtures and making these overtures, and finally it just goes beyond the pale. And things get very confrontational between Joseph and Potiphar's wife. And you remember what Joseph said in rebuffing her? How can I do this thing and sin against God? Joseph was able to look at Potiphar's wife as he should because he was looking at God as he should. And I think the same thing is true, although that's a horrible situation and one unapproved of by God. I think the same thing is true in marriage. I learn to look at my mate properly when I first look at God properly. And I evaluate myself, and thus I evaluate my mate or my mate-to-be through godly characteristics. This begins long before the marriage, before the wedding. Begins before the commitment, when by our inner transformation, we're bringing to the marriage the substance that will make that marriage last, if both certainly are bringing that to the marriage. Thus, we must make assessments of ourselves and our prospective mates on the inner man. And so as we begin to wonder if we're not yet married, as to who we will marry, or whether I should marry this one or that one, or what am I looking for in a prospective partner, what we need to do is concentrate on the inner man primarily. And we need to ask ourselves questions and ask questions of that other person. I don't mean verbally, but put them to the test. On the basis of what is it about that person that convinces me they are able to keep a lifetime commitment. We get so distracted with the superficial and the extraneous matters, we're asking sometimes all the wrong questions that have nothing to do with a lifetime commitment or have nothing to do with the character of that person. But if we want our marriages to last, and we want in our society, and we should want the statistics of marital soundness to rise, and we're determined to be part of that rise in our own individual lives, we've got to ask some deeper questions before we get married. Of ourselves and of our mate, how committed is he or she to the Lord? How committed is he or she to worship? Is there a reluctance? Is there a laziness? Or is there an eagerness to be with God's people? How diligent are they in studying the Scriptures? How much initiative do they take in engaging in spiritual things that are unplanned? That is, it's not a church function, but this is what they are. It grows out of who and what they are inside. How well does he or she keep his promises to me? If I find that this person I'm interested in is constantly breaking their word and undependable, do I think that suddenly they're going to be able to keep a lifetime commitment to marriage? How honest are they? Do I find them in little white lies? Do they skew the truth to put themselves in a more favorable light? How willing are they to sacrifice? Do they show compassion? Is it all about them? And as we're asking that question, we need to be asking it of ourselves. Do I fit that criteria? Am I someone that can be considered trustworthy enough by another person that they might commit themselves to me for a lifetime? Am I bringing that to the table? And is this person bringing that to the table? Trial marriage is not the answer. That's statistically proven. Trial marriage doesn't work. It's focusing on the wrong thing. The question is, who are we? And who is the real person that we're considering marrying? And there are people to be found of substance, of quality. We might have to turn over a few extra rocks looking for them. But they're there. We have to put ourselves in the right places. We have to sometimes network with good people to find them. But really the focus is, who are they and how do they view God? And who am I and how do I view God? And at the end of the day and the end of this sermon, there just aren't any shortcuts to this. If God says it ought to be done this way, we're not going to be able to come along with a shortcut and say, well, this will work just as well, or maybe better. That won't work. God's way is the best way. So as we draw our lesson to a close, we'll ask, have you obeyed the Lord in becoming His child in the way that God has said? Have you in your life put Him first in all things, and thus you're more able to put marital things in their proper perspective? If you've not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, which includes acknowledging Him verbally as the Son of God, confessing His name, it involves repenting and drawing a line in your life with God's help and saying, I will not be this anymore. I will be what God wants me to be. Repenting. If you've not been baptized, immersed in water for the remission of your sins, as the Lord has said we should, if you've not submitted yourself to those things, and would like to do that this morning, we'd like nothing better than to end our service in helping you obey the gospel. Can we serve you in some spiritual way as we stand and sing?